Shada Ibrahim is joining us now from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza to bring us up to speed on all the latest developments on the ground from the Gaza Strip. Qaeda, what do you have to share with us specifically as the assault on Gaza City continues to unfold now?
Falling victim to the Israeli brutal attacks and to the airstrikes the Israeli occupation army is waging and directing towards the civilian areas and the most populated areas in the Gaza Strip. And the focus of these attacks is surely Gaza City itself, which actually includes hundreds of thousands of people who had fled or escaped death in the north and in the east of the city towards the west. Nowadays, the west is actually jamming up with families who are displaced, who fled from the north and from the east of the city towards the coastal line, who are actually in very catastrophic situations and conditions as a result of the displacement, as a result of the continuation of the Israeli attacks. And today, they are living and experiencing unimaginable and indescribable situation as the Israeli occupation army launched its ground operation or ground offensive against them yesterday in the north of Gaza City. The Israeli tanks actually expanded and actually invaded many areas in the north of Gaza City, and actually now we are seeing and witnessing they are progressing from the north of the Sheikh Ridwan neighborhoods towards the heart of the city. And as they are progressing, more massacres are committed against the population, against the people here. More massacres and more airstrikes are targeting the most populated areas in the north of Gaza City. And the last massacre was in a Sheikh Ridwan neighborhood that resulted in the killing of seven people of the same family, Mas'ud family, after targeting the residential building. Another massacre targeted a group of civilians and a group of people who were fleeing from Tell el-Hawa neighborhoods. They were actually in a vehicle. The Israeli warplanes targeted the vehicle that was actually full of displaced people, for families and the children, of course. So that was a very horrible massacre also. Also, we are talking about the south of the city, the south of the Gaza Strip, which is actually not spared from the Israeli brutal attacks and from the Israeli artillery shelling. The more attacks are being carried out against the people in the south of the Strip, more massacres against the people are committed every passing hour. We are talking about at least 29 people killed from the dawn of this morning until now, and the number is increasing. The Israeli occupation army is not only attacking the people in north of the Strip, in Gaza City itself, but also in the south of the Gaza Strip, in the allegedly safe areas of Al-Nusayrat refugee camp, and also the south of Rafah and the west of Rafah, where the aid distribution centers are located. This morning, or in the past hour, a massacre was committed against the aid seekers in the west of Rafah itself that resulted in the killing of five at least and the injuries of more than 60 people. Among them, 20 are in critical conditions. The number is increasing as the Israeli occupation army keeps shooting and directly shooting towards the aid seekers in this area. This actually refutes the idea that more areas in the south of Gaza or in the middle area are safe zones or humanitarian zones. With one third of the casualties since the morning of this day until now were actually killed in the southern areas of the Gaza Strip. More people are still actually forced to go to these notorious aid distribution centers to go to seek aid or to collect whatever they can to feed themselves or to feed their families. And that highlights how the situation in Gaza is really very catastrophic from the humanitarian side. People are still in very dire need for the food and very dire need for the aid. However, they don't receive any aid as the Israeli occupation army keeps blocking the crossings and keeps disallowing the entry of aid to the humanitarian agencies and to the warehouses of the UNRWA. For example, for more than 6 months now, nothing has been allowed to enter the warehouses of the UNRWA, and the people are now living very catastrophic situations that are deteriorating every passing hour as the Israeli occupation army is deepening this humanitarian crisis by launching this ground invasion and by continuing the airstrikes and the operation, the military operations against the people here in the Gaza Strip.
All right, thanks a lot, Ghada Ibrahim, joining us from Deir al-Balah in central Gaza. Well, amid the mounting global rebuke against Israel, Canada has slammed as horrific The ground offensive in Gaza City, Canada's Ministry of Foreign Affairs said the offensive worsens the humanitarian crisis and puts in danger the release of Israeli captives held in Gaza. Ottawa also said Israel must comply with international law. Foreign Minister Anita Anand issued a separate message in support of Gaza. She said Canada, along with its international partners, demand a ceasefire in Gaza, as well as an immediate and permanent flow of humanitarian aid to the Palestinian territory. Ottawa earlier said it will vote in favor of the Palestinian statehood at a Security Council meeting on September 20th. In the U.S., a coalition of labor unions, faculties, and students in the University of California have sued Donald Trump's administration over its freezing of federal funds. The case, filed on Tuesday, challenges what the plaintiffs call a pattern of unlawful financial threats against higher education. Those who submitted the case say that Trump's freezing of federal funds is aimed at curbing academic freedom. The lawsuit comes weeks after the Trump administration fined the University of California $1.2 billion and froze research funding. The U.S. government has launched probes into universities over student protests and campuses against the genocide in Gaza and has frozen funds because of the protests and other issues. It has also sought massive payments from universities to settle the probes. Israeli forces have demolished 40 Palestinian homes in the village of Qasr al-Sir, located in the Negev desert in the occupied Palestine. The demolition sparked clashes between residents and Israeli forces, with local sources reporting that IOF fired sound and smoke bombs on residents protesting the destruction. The village is home to approximately 1,500 Palestinians, many of whom are living under increasingly harsh conditions. The village has witnessed similar incidents in recent months. Observers say the moves are part of a broader Israeli campaign aimed at confining Palestinian residents in the Negev desert to the smallest possible area. They say the plan is actually preparation for the construction of Israeli settlements there. Iran says the implementation of the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA will render the country's recent agreement with the IAEA null and void.
At the gathering of countries in Qatari capital of Doha, it was demonstrated that the threat posed by the Israeli regime is a shared and serious concern among all regional and Islamic nations.
Bahrain warned that if the other parties fail to fulfill their commitments or seek to blackmail Iran, Tehran will take necessary countermeasures. The spokesperson also announced that Iran's foreign minister will have a phone call later today with his counterparts from the European Troika and the EU foreign policy chief. Bahrain further stated that each passing day, regional countries are increasingly concluding that Israel is the real, serious, and urgent threat to the stability and security in the West Asia region.
Tehran's problem with the agency has been that it issued reports under the pressure and influence of the United States and the three European countries at various times. The agency had taken positions beyond its technical mandate.
Bahrain stressed that the threat posed by the Israeli regime goes beyond the region. He said Israel is the only regime that has occupied the territory of two neighboring countries while committing genocide in Gaza. Bahrain noted that there is no principle or objective of the UN Charter or international law that has not been violated by Israel. Further insight on that story, we're joined by author and commentator John Stepling, who's with us from Andorra, Norway. Mr. Stepling, welcome to the program. Let's just go over the recent comments coming from the spokesperson of the Iranian Foreign Ministry, stating that the implementation of the snapback mechanism of the JCPOA will render this recent agreement that Iran has reached with the IAEA null and void. Break that down for us, please.
Well, the fact that there is even this discussion taking place is a little preposterous. Iran has done everything going back 20-some years, has done everything it was asked to do by the IAEA. Inspectors came in, everything was fine. The only problem ever was Israeli and U.S. interference and complaints and so forth. Trump tore up the JCPOA. That's the end of that discussion. Meanwhile, Germany and the UK getting together the Troika to implement new sanctions on Iran. So what is Iran supposed to think of all of this? And there is, this is all taking place against the backdrop of the Arab League and OIC meeting in Qatar in Doha after the Israeli bombing, murder of Hamas. They missed the key figures, but a few other people died. A blatantly illegal bombing, aggression from Israel. So all of this is taking place against this security meeting. The security meeting, however, ends up being rather pointless too, because the real problem in all of this are the Arab monarchies, the Al-Thani family in Qatar, the Mohammed bin Salman in Saudi Arabia. All of the Gulf monarchies are corrupt. They all end up behind the scenes cooperating with Israel. And Iran is the one that continues to get bad press in the West, and yet Iran is the one who has done nothing except try to help the defense of Palestinians against this genocide somewhat, within very strict parameters they have helped. But still, they carry enormous prestige in the region, and at this point, you just think that diplomatic discussions are really pointless. I mean, first of all, if Iran wants to build an atomic weapon, they should go and build one. I don't know what it is that the United States and Israel think they have the right to tell Iran what to do, or anybody else tell Iran what to do. Countries have sovereignty. They have autonomy. They should be able to make their own choices. There's, you know, how many countries are nuclear armed? So all of this extraordinarily kind of bureaucratic and diplomatic posturing and endless hours of discussion and photo ops and, amounts to nothing. Iran should do what it wants. The U.S. tore up the agreement. Other countries are in violation of international law. Israel has violated every possible international law that is on the books and continues to do so, and that should be the real discussion.
All right, we're going to leave it there. Author and commentator John Stepling joining us from Inderøy, Norway. Moving on, the second conference of Iran and the Economic Cooperation Organization has kicked off in Tehran. It brings together senior officials and regional representatives for discussions to shape the future direction of the bloc. The discussions come as the organization approaches the end of its 2025 roadmap, setting the stage for a new 10-year vision plan. Gisumi Shamari has more.
In Tehran, regional cooperation takes center stage. The second National Iran ECHO Conference has opened at the Foreign Ministry's Institute for Political and International Studies, with foreign ministers, policymakers, and academics in attendance.
The organization has tremendous potential. Moving toward multilateralism is one of our key objectives. That's why Iran decided to host this meeting, to take the initiative at a crucial moment as we prepare the next 10-year plan, known as Vision 2035.
ECHO traces its roots back to 1964, when Iran, Turkey, and Pakistan created the Regional Cooperation for Development. Today, the organization spans 10 countries, covering more than 8 million square kilometers and serving over 500 million people. Yet, experts say its full potential remains untapped.
Connectivity, trade integration, agriculture, food security promotion, and most importantly, relying on technology and artificial intelligence and digitalization. Now, these are new areas, but what we also want to hear from and what we also want to include in our processes is the active participation of the youth and the women.
This year marks the final phase of the ECHO 2025 roadmap. The new 10-year vision will be adopted at the upcoming Council of Foreign Ministers meeting in Kazakhstan this November.
As we plan Vision 2035, Our goal is to ensure it drives the economic growth of member states. At the same time, we must integrate new technologies and develop strategies to adapt to the changes they bring.
Iran has outlined future priorities, from trade liberalization and transit facilitation to digital transformation and artificial intelligence. As host nation and founding member, Iran sees ECHO as a tool to strengthen multilateral diplomacy and neighborhood policy. As the second Iran ECHO National Conference underscores lessons learned, Iran leads the way in planning Vision 2035, highlighting new strategies for the next decade. Yusumish Ahmadi, Tehran.
That's it with the world news for now. Bye, everybody.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Today's special.
Assalamu alaikum.
It's special for you. We present to you today. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim, in the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful. Salam to you, dear brother, dear sister, in faith and humanity. So welcome, you are listening to today's special from IRIB English Radio, which in this program we're going to speak about turning setbacks into success. So be with us. Today is Wednesday, 24th of Rabiul Awal, 1447 of the Islamic Lunar Hijri calendar, corresponding to the 26th of the month of Shahrivar, 1404 of the solar calendar, and the 17th of September, 2025 of the Christian Gregorian calendar. We open Allah's book and we'll listen to verse 177 of chapter Al-Baqarah.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Laysal birra an tuwallu wujuhakum qibala al-mashriqi wal-maghribi walakinnal birra man amana billah walakinnal birra man amana billah الآخر والملائكة والكتاب والنبيين وآتى المال على حبه ذوي القربى واليتامى والمساكين وابن السبيل والسائلين وفي الرقاب وأقام الصلاة وآتى الزكاة والموفون بعهدهم إذا عاهدوا والصابرين في البأساء والضراء وحين البأس أولئك الذين صدقوا وأولئك هم المتقون.
Righteousness is not that you turn your faces toward the east or the west, but true righteousness is in one who believes in Allah, the last day, the angels, the book, and the prophets, and gives wealth, in spite of love for it, to relatives, orphans, the needy, the traveler, those who ask for help, and for freeing slaves, and who establishes prayer and gives zakah, those who fulfill their promise when they promise, and those who are patient in poverty and hardship and during battle. Those are the ones who have been true, and it is those who are the righteous.
La ilaha illallah, la ilaha illallah.
Bless your day with contemplation on the verses of the Holy Quran.
The faith of a person in Allah causes him to be humble before Him and to stand firm with no obedience before tyrants. Where the faith in resurrection creates eyesight and magnanimity, and faith in angels refers to the existence of belief in the processes of supernatural, including the faith in revelation, providence, and etc. Faith in prophets is a belief in a straight way and true guidance existing throughout history. It's evidence leading to the fact that man has never been aimless and absolutely free in this world.
Just the words of Allah, mercy and kindness and hope for everyone. Peace be upon you, O Muhammad.
We go straightly toward the topic of this episode, turning setbacks into success. The prevalent fear that can negatively affect a person's life is the fear of failing. People may become fearful of taking chances or attempting new things as a result, which may prevent them from realizing their full potential. Failure to worry can cause stress and anxiety, both of which are harmful to a person's physical and mental health. A way to overcome the fear of failure is to reframe your thinking. Instead of seeing failure as a negative outcome, try to see it as a learning opportunity. Remind yourself that everyone fails at some point, and that's a natural part of the learning and growth process. It can also be helpful to set achievable goals for yourself and to celebrate small wins along the way. This can help you build confidence and resilience and make it easier to handle setbacks or failures when they occur.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, may Allah's peace and blessings be upon the Holy Prophet of Islam. Dear brothers and sisters, assalamu alaikum and welcome to today's special. This is Ali, your host. Today we are going to talk about how to turn failure into success. It is important to understand that these difficult situations happen by the will of Allah.
And although they might feel like a defeat or a disaster, they are a means to success, or they are a lesson. They may even be a reward, but perhaps we may not recognize without the help of hindsight. Let's look at Quran again, chapter 9. Nothing will befall us except what Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed for us. Again, moreover, chapter 2, verses 155 to 157. We shall certainly test you by afflicting you with fear, hunger, loss of properties, and lives and fruits. Give glad tidings then to those who remain patient. Those who, when any affliction smites them, they say, verily, we belong to Allah, and it is to Him we shall return. Upon them will be the blessings of their Lord, and it is they who are rightly guided. So the condition is that contentment with Allah's decree.
Reflecting on different Islamic topics, short commentary of the Holy Quran, hadiths of the Infallibles, lessons from the life of the Infallibles, all in today's special from IRIB English Radio.
It's very strange, but let's look at the benefits of failure. Failure builds a strength of character. Yes. Facing failure is great for building your strength of character. Dealing with projects that didn't go as planned or completely failed can really test your determination, courage, and resolve. But managing to pick yourself up and start again can prove to yourself that you are made of tougher stuff. Failure can make you work harder. That's another fact. Successful people have often said that their biggest failures became their greatest inspirations. They are refused to be beaten by failing and start again with even more self-motivation to succeed.
My life is not the same when I'm too concerned by what they say. Why should I wanna have you? To doubt you would be the worst mistake. Deep inside I know, amidst all the darkness and everything which makes no sense, I know that you exist. You are the light. You guides me through my darkest nights. Shows me right from wrong. That often lies, 'cause I don't need anyone, anything in life, but you. No, I don't need anyone to show me my way. No, I don't need anyone but you.
This is today's special, which looks at the ways to turn failure into success. One of the ways is this. Failure is a ladder to success, not a setback. That viewpoint is very important. Considering failure as a progressive move forward, success rather than a regressive one, is a transformative mindness shift that can greatly influence one's ability to bounce back, stay motivated, and maintain a positive perspective throughout one's endeavors. This enables you to reinterpret setbacks as chances for personal development and advancement. Benefits of considering failure as a stepping stone to success. This is another way. Keeps you motivated and encourages you to bounce back. Helps you analyze and learn from experiences. Cultivates a positive outlook. Helps you mitigate challenges.
There are two
schools of thought when it comes to tawakkul. Yes, there is the tawakkul that is espoused by certain individuals, which means that we leave everything to Allah and we don't do anything. There are some of these Sufi mystics, they go on the desert, they do not work, they say, whatever Allah gives me, this is tawakkul, I would not work. I will do whatever Allah wants me to, and He will provide me with the rizq, whatever it will come. Another school says, no, I will do whatever is necessary. If it doesn't work, then I will turn to Allah. Then I will ask Allah, because this world is full of asbab, full of means, yes? It is neither this or this. Somebody asked the messenger of Allah, he said, Ya Rasulallah, what is the definition of tawakkul? I have my camel, yes, and I want to look after this camel. Should I leave it outside the mosque just like that and say, Ya Allah, look after it? What should I do? The Prophet of Islam says, tie it and say, Ya Allah, look after it. It is both what? The notion of utilizing the means, but recognizing that without Allah, it will not be fulfilled. It is the combination of submission and reliance on Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, but at the same time, knowing that He has made things that are the means. Once Musa alayhi salam became ill, he said, I will not take any medicine. I will only ask Allah. He will cure me. وَإِذَا مَرِثْتُ فَهُوَ يَشْفِينَ. Yes, the Quran says, when I am ill, it is He who gives me the cure. Allah reveals to Musa, O Musa, if you do not take the medicine, by my might and glory, I will never cure you. Why? He says, you take the medicine and you believe that I am the one who cured you. And you place your submission in my hands, but you take the medicine. Yes? So this tawakkul, Allah says, وَتَوَكَّلْ عَلَى اللَّهِ وَكَفَى بِاللَّهِ وَكِيلًا. How can you rely on other human beings?
Thank you very much for listening to this episode of today's special from IRIB English Radio. Inshallah, we'll meet you soon. Till then, fi amanillah.
They told me that I'm crazy, who you praying for? They told me there is nothing, who you looking for? Doing what you're doing, cause there is no hope. Just come with me, I'll show you what's behind your door. And they showed me all kind of lies. My eyes were locked, yes, I was mesmerized. But deep inside, I know that there's a better world. Cause I'm a believer.
Life as you know, you reap what you sow, and when you do good, Allah will protect you and stop you falling down. I
picturesque town of Kasimov, deep out there in the endless plains of rural Russia. It was a grand town once, wealthy in imperial times. The Russian Tsar came to visit. Now it is as much known for tourism as anything else. With its rich history and idyllic location above the Oka River, there is also a stunning 600-year-old mosque. This land is where Europe and Asia meet. I'm here to speak to Austria's former foreign minister, Karin Kneisel. She has effectively been exiled from Europe because she promoted good relations with Russia. And she now calls this beautiful town of Kasimov her home.
Mrs. Kneisel, the Americans recently concluded a deal to operate the Zanzibar corridor through Azerbaijan. It's been given a very Trumpian name, the Trump route for international peace and prosperity. Particularly the Iranians seem a bit worried about this. Are they being paranoid, or are they right to be worried?
No, well, if I put myself in the place of the Iranian government, and also I would say average Iranian, I would also be worried. I would not be amused, to put it in a British way, because it means that this lease of Armenian territory by the U.S. Government, by a group of security companies, logistic companies, which are all somehow related to security agencies, they are just at in the very close geographic proximity of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So I can fully understand their second thoughts.
We know this region is very important for Russia and Iran. It links the two countries. We also know that Russia is effectively at the moment fighting a war against NATO, and that some NATO countries are interested in the Caucasus as well to destabilize perhaps both countries, Russia and Iran. There have been some commentators in Russia who are really sounding the alarm over what is happening there. Do you think it is dangerous to have the Americans controlling this corridor for the Russians as well?
Well, I would say it could cause some hiccups for a number of countries, also for Turkey, because of course, this corridor opens trade possibilities for Turkey, but on the other hand, they have American security agencies just in front of the door. It could also cause hiccups for China, because the People's Republic of China has been constructing its Go West corridor, the Belt and Road Initiative, for the last 12 years. So here, all of a sudden, they have now some sort of new trade scheme, which might conflict with their trade schemes. Plus, and here comes Russia into the game, Russia and Iran are building up the North-South trade corridor, which is an interesting combination of different forms of transport. It would involve river navigation on the Volga River. It would involve container on different highways that have been constructed, plus also maritime transport. So the North-South corridor, which is a very ambitious project, not yet really implemented, here I think that the Russians could be, well, again, let me say, not too much amused. This from a trade point of view, from a national security point of view, and the critical voices that you can read and hear here in Russia about this scheme, and you said they're sounding alarm. Yes, I also read these bloggers and listen to these commentators. I think what they would like to point out is the following. The Caucasus, the Southern Caucasus in particular, has always been a hot spot of rivalry, of all sort of ethno-tribal warfare, plus great power politics. The so-called Great Game, it did not concern only Central Asia. It was also all about this rivalry between the British Empire, the Russian Tsarist Empire, and the Indian Empire, which was more and more eaten up by the British, and of course the Persian Empire, which under the dynasty of the Qajar was totally unable, military unable to make sure that it would not lose territory. And it was the Persian Empire under the Qajar dynasty that lost territory. It lost Armenia. It lost Azerbaijan to Russia, and later on Azerbaijan and Armenia were part of the Soviet republics, and it lost other parts of the Caucasus. So this region has seen some wandering frontiers, and it has always been some sort of hot spot, and you can easily instrumentalize a small group to make troubles. And plus, the Caucasus is a corridor, as this Trump corridor says, and when you take, for instance, the pipeline that BP built in the early 2000s, going from Baku in Azerbaijan via Tbilisi, the Georgian capital, to Ceyhan in Turkey. This pipeline, let me recall for our audience, was only possible after a war in Chechnya, and maybe this pipeline project by BP, British Petroleum, Beyond Petroleum, whatever you would like to call them, they call themselves Beyond Petroleum, but sometimes they act as British Petroleum when they're in troubles. And this company maybe was also involved, I have no evidence for that, but maybe was involved in certain changes that we saw in Georgia in the early 2000s. The pipeline initially was conceived as crossing Chechnya, and that was a great momentum for the Chechens to fight for independence, because they thought, oh, we have a transit fee that will be our income. So it's all interconnected, and we know the troubles that the Chechen war made, and there were two big Chechen wars, one in the early 1990s and the second one in the early 2000s. So there are many, many elements that if you add all of them up together, you can see the powder keg.
So I read an article recently in an American foreign policy magazine saying that the Americans can try and sell this to the Russians, because it's important to get Russian support, or at least not too much opposition from them, to sweeten the deal for Russia so that Russia can benefit from it economically as well. Do you think any kind of deal in the Caucasus will be tied to, as you say, the great game, maybe even conversations in Alaska, at least the Trump administration trying to bring Russia closer to the United States? Do you think Azerbaijan can be a part of that?
Well, Azerbaijan is not an isolated element. Azerbaijan is connected, as we see, to whatever is happening in Turkey. And here the question is, who controls who, if I may say, or who monitors who? Is it Ankara, which does it with Baku, or maybe a Baku that somehow monitors Ankara? It depends on the situation. Plus, we have, of course, also the big actor China, for which the Caucasus and this entire region is the entry gate to their markets. And Turkey is an important market. I would say it's much more important than whatever remains of Europe, because demographically speaking and financially speaking, Europe is not such an interesting market in the long run. But Turkey is, and Russia is, and the Caucasus, we really have to understand it in its geographic importance. And the old German statesman Otto von Bismarck said once upon a time, without using the word geopolitics, but maybe he was one of the first geopolitical thinkers, he said, geography is the constant factor of history. Geographie ist die Konstante der Geschichte. And we see the return of geography on all levels. So such a corridor across Armenian territory to connect two pieces of land belonging to Azerbaijan, but at the same time very close to the border with the Islamic Republic of Iran, all that makes a lot of people think twice.
Do you think it could lead to war?
We are in a series of frozen conflicts there. None of those conflicts has been truly resolved. What was signed in Washington on the 8th of August was not yet a peace agreement. It was a memorandum, it was an exchange of documents. I don't want to underestimate the importance of that meeting, the signature by both presidents, Aliyev and Pashinyan, together with President Trump, but it's not yet a peace treaty. And whatever we have seen in the this, none of this conflict is really solved, that you can speak of peace. We have many fragmented territories there. We have, and by the way, the great Russian writer Lev Tolstoy and also Mikhail Lermontov, they were both shaped by their soldiers' life in that region. So you cannot imagine a masterpiece like War and Peace, the epic, the big epic of Russian literature, without the Caucasus.
And what do you think it says about Iranian-Russian relations? How would you assess that now? It's flashpoints like this, disagreements that do does throw up questions about how important these two nations are to each other. There are some who believe there is a global war going on between the East and the West, that Iran's survival and security is essential for Russia, and indeed vice versa. Would you go that far, or can there be disagreements between them?
Between Washington and Moscow?
Between Tehran and Moscow.
Ah, between Tehran and Moscow especially. Of course, there can be agreements and disagreements, and it's not a kind of smooth path that they will converge on everything and anything. And there is now a growing partnership. It has recently been boosted up by also some military exchanges, which did not exist beforehand. But Russia and Iran are neighboring countries which share the Caspian Sea, which is not a sea, it's a lake, because it's not connected to the open sea. And we have always had there all sorts of troubles in the Caspian Sea, whether it was fishing rights, whether it was drilling, oil and gas, pollution coming with that. So this lake, the Caspian Lake, is definitely one of the many points of, could be, of divergence, because there had been problems in the past, and they managed in 19th century to settle certain things. Also, let us recall that the times of the Soviet Union, the Soviet Union existed until 1991, and the Islamic Republic of Iran got into existence in 1979. And on the one hand, you had the so-called Azeriist Communist Empire. On the other side, the one party that was considered as a not always accepted opposition was the Tudeh Communist Party in Iran. And there were also all kinds of accusations about interference. We have seen in history, we see in present day, also points of divergence. But of course, it's all a matter of how you handle that. And I always say, for me, Russia is a country of the East. It's not Europe. Some people might not like it, but why do I say, luckily, it's a country of the East, like Iran? The East knows the many shades of gray. While the more you go to the West, especially the Europe of these days, it's all about black and white. So you're either with us or against us. And having traveled to Iran on many occasions, living now in Russia, having somehow grown up in the Arab West Asian countries, I more and more know how to cherish this opaque grayish. As a person with, if you want, some Germanic background, of course, at certain instances in my life, it troubled me, because I said, it's so Byzantine, it's so opaque, it's not clear, I want to see more clearly. It's corrupt, you can also say, but it gives you the possibility to live next to each other, not necessarily with each other, but next to each other. And this is the mastery of the Easterners.
Let me turn to the horror that's happening in Gaza and wider Palestine. Sergei Lavrov recently said that by the time European leaders get around to recognizing Palestine, it will no longer exist. What do you think he meant by that, and do you agree?
Yes, yes. We are in real time witnessing a genocide. While we talk to each other, most probably the 60,000 Israeli reservists are called up to make their final attack on Gaza City. What we see is a genocide in real time. And many countries have called a spade. President Putin said already in autumn 23, what is happening in Gaza reminds him of the Leningrad blockade, of the starvation of a city during 1,000 days. This is what is going on. Many EU capitals remain silent, not all of them. Ireland, Spain, they opened their mouths. But when we take countries like Germany and Austria, they are just quiet.
What is happening in Germany, in Austria a little less, but in Germany particularly, if you protest for Palestine, you're arrested now. It seems, particularly Germany, seems
Austria.
And Austria as well.
Yeah.
It seems disturbing the level of protection they are giving to, as you say, this genocide in Israel.
Yeah. And it's not only political circus, it's not only the media. It's nearly impossible to be slightly critical of Israel. It's in German we say the antisemitismus keule, it's the stick of antisemitism that is immediately used against a person when you want to cause him or her troubles. That happened to me. I happen to speak Hebrew, I happen to speak Arabic, and first thing I was called when I was appointed, or when my name was in discussion about becoming maybe Minister of Foreign Affairs, there were immediately press releases and press lobby campaigns to call me an anti-Semite. And this people are very much afraid of that, because it can destroy your career, it can make you lose friends. Germans and Austrians in general are very much prudent, coward on that topic.
Who can help the Palestinians now? It seems the world has forsaken them. Who can really help them?
The Palestinians were always left in the rain by the Arab brothers. And when the whole disaster started in October 2023, I was not very sure that there would be some support by Arab and Muslim brothers. We saw also with the late Secretary General Hassan Nasrallah of Hezbollah, they were not about entering in a fully fledged confrontation with Israel because of what was going on in Gaza. There was a lot of political discourse, but Nasrallah and many of his members were killed despite the fact that they did not want to have an open conflict with Israel. And there was criticism by Palestinians and in Lebanon also. The only people that is really, if you want, interfering in a certain way is Yemen. So otherwise, what do you take the Arab monarchies of the Arabian Peninsula, whether you take huge countries like Egypt, bordering to Gaza, the Philadelphia corridor, we see that the Palestinians, not for the first time in the history, are left in the rain by their brothers and sisters in the Arab and in the Islamic world by and large.
I sometimes think that how the Arab states are not doing anything to help Palestinians. Then I think of Europe, when in European countries, not only doing nothing for the Ukrainians, they're throwing them to their deaths. Mm. So I sort of get some perspective on wondering who is worse. The Russian position seems is still a two-state solution in Palestine. Increasingly I see anti-Zionist scholars and activists and spokespeople increasingly turning against that idea of a two-state solution is possible. Do you think the Russian position is still correct? Do you think it'll change?
Well, first of all, I would say it's good that it's recalling, it's reminding the rest of the world. People, we have a UN Security Council list of resolution on the need for a two-state solution. But for many, it has become more a ritual than a real political topic. And when President Putin was asked 1 or 2 years ago, so what's the solution to the turmoil in the West Asian region, he said the core of the problem is the Palestinian question, and we need a Palestinian state. I don't know any current head of state, prime minister in any country that would be so clear about it. You know, yes, maybe South Africa. But many would tell you, well, problem is the realization, the problem is where would be a viable Palestinian state, and with the current settlement decisions of Male Adumim, which would truly cut off East Jerusalem from the West Bank, from West Jordan land, there's little protest in the Western world. There's so Russia, two-state solution, not only as a ritual, but reminding that this is necessary. Now, how to put that into action? Some 35 years ago, I wrote my PhD thesis about that. And the one of the scenarios that I developed is you have to move away from territorial federalism to personal federalism, as it was in the Ottoman Empire. I don't want now to say how great and fantastic the Ottoman Empire was, but in that empire, you could speak your language, live your religious way of life in a federal way. The milieu were conceived like that. How to draw borders, how to get rid of hundreds of thousands of Jewish settlers in the West Bank, in the occupied territories, it's a huge question. And we see now what's going on in Gaza, that those 8,000 Jewish settlers who were carried out by the Israeli army back in 2006, they are coming back, their children, grandchildren are back. And we see a demographic change in Israel due to the fact also that it's the national religious settlers who have more children. So whatever remains of a secular Israel is disappearing also in the